Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, June 26, 2020. I'm your reader, Alan Frederico. Here's a look at what I'll be reading today. First, I'll take a look at the weather, then the mini editorial, and then front page stories and inside stories of local interest. About 20 minutes after the hour, I'll read letters to the editor and editorials if there are any locals, and again, I don't think there are. Then at 8:30, I'll read the obituaries. After that, it'll be feature stories, sports, and other stories as time allows. First, here's the weather. Well, partly cloudy today, 87 for a high, 62 tonight. We got overnight just a little bit of rain, I think 0.05 of an inch at the most. Airport reports 0.04, but at my house, it was maybe a little more. And there's no rain in the forecast after today until late next week. So Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, highs are going to be 87, 92, 92, and 90. With the nighttime lows in the 70s for the most part. So probably pretty warm and sultry for the next week. Today's record high is 101, which is set in 1936. And our record low was 46, which is set in 1926. The sun and the moon, today the sun is going to rise, did rise at 5:50. We'll set at 9:07 tonight. So still a long day of daylight through June, and tomorrow almost now. Here's the mini editorial. Steve Hansen of Sioux City says, "You have a First Amendment right to protest peaceably. Vandalism and looting are criminal offenses and are, and should be, punishable by law. Exercise your right, not your lack of self-control." That again from Steve Hansen of Sioux City. Now here's the lead story. The headline reads, "Sioux City College campuses offer picturesque setting. Decorative green grasses and burgundy-striped petunias add pops of color in front of Morningside College's Lewis Hall, while yellow daylilies flank the doors of Stark Student Center across town at Briarcliff University." Tim Paul credits a crew of a dozen, including 10 high school students, for keeping the landscaping on Morningside College's campus looking top-notch. "We had the ability to hire local high school students. We've had them since early May," said Paul, the Sioux City College's director of physical plant. "They're just doing a phenomenal job of keeping everything planted and watered and growing." Briarcliff University President Rochelle Carstens said Briarcliff always looks good this time of year. She said the college's facilities department is in charge of maintaining the landscaping, which includes flowers, prairie grass, and natural grass, she said. Environmental students also do some work on the prairie, which is located on the backside of the cliff. "This is just a beautiful time of year to be on the cliff," she said. While Paul said Morningside's crew was able to get things planted a little earlier than normal, he said he doesn't think the lack of student traffic has really played a part in improving the look of the grounds. Due to the global COVID-19 pandemic, there are no summer classes being held on campus. "This is the first year that we have insourced our mowing. I think that might be a part of it. We have our own crew taking care of it now." Paul said the crew follows a zoned maintenance schedule. For example, grass isn't cut and then left to grow for a week. Instead, Paul said the crew addresses certain zones throughout the campus on a daily basis. "We don't cut everything once a week and then wait a whole week for it to grow, and it kind of looks like it's overgrown," he said. "We do it on a zone-type basis. Therefore, it kind of keeps everything consistent and even." Karsten said summers are normally a quiet time on campus. She said an increasing number of student-athletes will return after the 4th of July. "Feel free to drive by. It's a beautiful locale," she said. And some photographs accompanying this article show the beautiful campuses at both Morningside and at Briarcliff. The only other stories on the front page this morning are national stories, and I'll just read the headlines. The first one is U.S. daily virus cases near a peak, and then Trump's trip to Rushmore draws fire. Okay, well, here's the local story from page A3 about Woodbury, Buena Vista, and other counties each record a COVID-19 death. Dateline Sioux City by Dolly Butts. Woodbury and Buena Vista counties each recorded a death due to the novel coronavirus Thursday. Siouxland District Health Department announced Woodbury County's 43rd COVID-19 related death, a woman between the ages of 61 and 80, along with 5 new cases of the virus out of 121 tests. As of 6 p.m., Woodbury County's case total stood at 3,097, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health Statistics. District Health reports that 2,640 patients have recovered. The death in Buena Vista County brings its total to 11. The Northwest Iowa County currently has 1,678 cases. Across the Missouri River, three more cases of the virus were recorded in Dakota County. The Northeast Nebraska County now has 1,761 cases and 34 deaths. In their daily joint release, Mercy One Siouxland Medical Center and Unity Point Health St. Luke's said they are caring for a combined 29 patients for COVID-19-related issues, down from Wednesday's count of 34. State statistics, which were last updated Thursday, showed that in Regional Medical Coordination Center 3, which includes us, many Northwest Iowa counties, 34 people were hospitalized with COVID-19, and three had been admitted within the past 24 hours. The region had 109 intensive care unit beds and 100 ventilators available. Five patients in the region were on ventilators, the statistics showed. And a Sioux City man has been arrested for the Grandview Park bandshell graffiti. A Sioux City man was arrested early Thursday morning in connection with a graffiti incident at the Grandview Park bandshell. According to a press release from the Sioux City Police Department, 23-year-old Estevan Avila of Sioux City was located in the park at around 6:49 a.m. Thursday. Avila was charged with third-degree criminal mischief, possession of methamphetamine, and possession of drug paraphernalia. He was held in the Woodbury County Jail on $3,300 bond. The graffiti on the bandshell, the 1930s structure listed on the National Register of Historic Places, comes just a week after, just a day after racist graffiti was found on a restroom at War Eagle Park. It's unclear if the graffiti was motivated by politics or activism, as most of the bright colored phrases and doodles appeared to be apolitical in nature. One side of the bandshell, however, had the acronym ACAB, a shorthand for a vulgar phrase implicating the police, seen frequently in Minneapolis during the uprising after the police killing of George Floyd. Another side of the bandshell had the acronym BLM, shorthand for Black Lives Matter, as well as 187, a number commonly seen in graffiti messages that traces its roots to the California Penal Code listing for homicide. City crews were last seen Thursday power washing the spray paint from the bandshell. Also from page A3 of the journal, Black History Celebration is scheduled for July 4th. The community is invited to Back in Black, a celebration of Black history in Siouxland, starting at 1 p.m. July 4th in Grandview Park. The event will be fun, free, and family-friendly, according to Jasmine Preston, founder of the Siouxland Outreach Initiative. We wanted to celebrate Black history in a very inclusive way, she said. It isn't about who invented the peanut. It's about the Siouxland people from all races, religions, and nationalities who've made a difference. For instance, there will be a pop-up history museum filled with photographs and artifacts from the past all the way to the present. In addition, children will be able to play in a kids' zone, and families can enjoy food and a full slate of musical acts coming from every genre. At dusk, the film from 2018, The Hate You Give, based upon a young adult novel by Audrey Wells, will be shown. Preston said the PG-13 movie may open some eyes as well as start a new discussion, which is the underlying message of Back in Black. We'll be holding an auction to secure body cameras for the Sioux City Police Department, but we also want to celebrate the community's Black history, Preston said. This event was started by the Siouxland Outreach Initiative, but many other nonprofit groups, service groups, and student groups also helped out. We want this event to be part of a continuing effort to educate and unify the community, she added. Plus, Preston wants to keep everyone safe. We will be following COVID-19 guidelines by ensuring everyone is following social distancing requirements, she said. Even though face masks aren't mandatory, we're encouraging people to wear them anyway. Preston also suggests people bring their own chairs and blankets from home. For those who don't feel comfortable with public events, she said, Back in Black will be live streamed on the internet. I want people to understand that it doesn't matter what race you are We can all make a difference, she said. News this time from page A5 of the journal. Sioux City PC NAACP president, Unity in the Community founder, named to task force. Sioux City Police Chief Rex Mueller, NAACP president Ike Rayford, one of our readers, and Sioux City Community School Board member and Unity in the Community founder Monique Scarlett were among 14 Iowa officials named as members of the new Law Enforcement Vision for Equality Task Force. The task force started as a reaction to the May 25th death of George Floyd, a Black Minneapolis man who died while in police custody, as a partnership between the Iowa Police Association and the Iowa-Nebraska NAACP State Area Conference of Branch. During a Wednesday morning news conference, Mueller said the Sioux City Police Department has a long history of reaching out to all segments of the community. More work needs to be done. We have been doing community policing for a long time, and it has been an evolution, he said. As a police force, we need to know what has been accomplished and things that still need to be addressed. Mueller added that the task force will allow for the exchange of ideas between law enforcement professionals and civil rights advocates from around the state. And the Sioux City Municipal Band is set to play on Sunday. The Sioux City Municipal Band will present the next in its series of summer concerts at 7:30 p.m. Sunday at the Grandview Park Bandshell. To comply with COVID-19 social distancing guidelines for the band, the concert will feature three smaller ensembles from within the band: a percussion trio, a saxophone quartet, and a woodwind quintet. The scheduled music playlist will include Duke Ellington's Satin Doll, The Beatles' When I'm 64, Marvin Hamlisch's The Way We Were, and Aram Kucharan's Saber Dance, as well as other numbers. Grandview Park allows for plenty of space for audiences to maintain social distancing during the concerts, which are presented by the Sioux City Parks and Recreation Department. And more road construction work as Hamilton Boulevard will close for ramp work. Construction work at Exit 149 and Interstate 29 will require the closing of Hamilton Boulevard to traffic beginning July 7th. Weather permitting, the project will continue until November 7th, according to the Iowa Department of Transportation. During this closure, the Interstate 29 ramps at Hamilton will remain open. Hamilton traffic wishing to access northbound I-29 and traffic wishing to access southbound Interstate 29 will use separate detours. That article really doesn't explain very well how Hamilton's going to be closed from July 7th to November 7th if they've got the ramps open. Oh, well. And Dort adds classes to address health crisis. Dort University is adding a new or revised program offerings, including a place to give college students more expertise regarding public health crises, such as the ongoing novel coronavirus spread. Those new pieces were announced in a Thursday press release as the education and biology departments have developed new program opportunities for students. One component includes a new public health emphasis for biology majors, which the release said is important, as such knowledge is needed for students who could work within the public health field. Professor Jeff Plukstra said trends in public health continue to show the need for greater emphasis on proactive approaches to health and wellness. Plukstra said that in the midst of public health crises like COVID-19, it is vitally important to take public health seriously. New endorsements are available in the education department as well, including a joint agriculture/biology education major and an expanded agriculture education major. Dort is one of three schools in Iowa offering an agriculture education program, the only one to offer it from a Christian perspective, said. Sioux City Public Museum and Art Center Interpretive Center will reopen July 7th. The Sioux City Public Museum and the Sioux City Art Center and the Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center have all announced plans to reopen to the public on July 7th. All of the facilities have been closed since March due to COVID-19 concerns. Each will have new hand sanitizing stations and will require social distancing. Surfaces like restrooms and door handles will be cleaned and disinfected frequently. Facility personnel will be required to wear face masks, and visitors are also encouraged to wear face masks. The museum at 607 4th Street will resume with its normal operating hours of 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Tuesday through Saturday and 1 to 5 Sundays on July 7th. It will launch a new summer exhibit that will celebrate what would have been the 30th year of Saturday in the Park, planned prior to the postponed concert festival. Saturday in the Park, 29 Years of Memories, will feature memorabilia, slideshows, and 1960 Wurlitzer Model 24-10S jukebox and a 1957 Hammond Model RT3 concert organ. City of Hope, Resurrection City, and the 1968 Poor People's Campaign, a traveling exhibit from the Smithsonian, will resume its interrupted run. It examines the Poor People's Campaign, a grassroots multiracial movement that drew thousands of people to Washington, D.C. for 43 days in the summer of 1968. Selections from the Vernon Tott Collection will extend its abbreviated run, an exhibit featuring a local soldier's powerful photos of prisoners of a World War II concentration camp. It is designed to mark the 75th anniversary of the liberation of the Alhem concentration camp. In addition, the museum will continue to post its monthly History at High Noon presentation online while introducing a new online series, Sioux City Pride Roots, a project which preserves Sioux City's LGBTQ community, which is slated to launch on Thursday. The Arts Center at 225 Nebraska Street will open its doors from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday and Saturday, from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. Thursday, and 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. on Sundays. However, the public will only have access to the first floor gallery. Classes in the Gilchrist Learning Center have been canceled for the time being. So has entry into the Junior League Hands-On Gallery. The Art Center will open Local Perspectives, a juried exhibition by more than 40 Siouxland artists, on July 11th. This will be a virtual exhibit until it is determined that the public can view it in person. The Lewis and Clark Interpretive Center and Betty Strong Encounter Center at 900 Larson Park Road will be open from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Tuesday through Friday and noon to 5 Saturday and Sunday. For the time being, all interactive exhibits will be discontinued. In addition, concerts and lectures will be posted online via Facebook Live. The Sergeant Floyd River Museum and Welcome Center at 1000 Larson Park Road will remain closed to the public. Also, its annual Bill Diamond Antique and Classic Car Show, which it was scheduled for July 12th, has been canceled for 2020. And in a story that was first reported here last week, Park Jefferson has been forced to cancel its races. An insurance issue causes the track to put racing on hold. After being one of the first tracks in the nation to open during the COVID-19 pandemic back in April, Park Jefferson Speedway was forced to cancel races in all of its forms for the rest of June. Due to insurance issues, Park Jefferson owner Adam Adamson was forced to cancel the IMCA weekly racing on June 13th and then the USMTS races on June 15th. The biggest blow was having to cancel the Midwest Madness Tour event, which was scheduled to run on Saturday, June 27th. Drivers from Texas, California, and around the nation were scheduled to appear at the event, including Ricky Thornton Jr., who won at the track back in April, until Adamson had to cancel the event earlier this month. "We were excited to have them at Park Jefferson. Unfortunately, we can't have it," Adamson said. "We're going to kick some money over to the Raceway Park on Sunday, $200 to help make sure they have a good support from the drivers. We're bummed out we won't get a chance to race at Park Jefferson. We're working with the Jefferson Township and working on the paperwork and working to get it set so we can race again." Adamson hopes everything is resolved so Park Jefferson Speedway can host its IMCA weekly races on July 18th and the IMCA Dirt Nights on July 20th. The insurance issue came about because of the national attention Park Jefferson received with some of the big races it has hosted this spring because it was one of the first tracks to open. So most of the track's races were television on Speed Shift TV on Flow Racing, which has since bought Speed Shift TV. Park Jefferson Speedway is located just off Route 105, which is just north of North Sioux City, and is located in Jefferson, South Dakota Township. Park Jefferson's official address is 4840 426 332nd Street, which is just south of the track. 332nd Street is a gravel surface road that runs a couple of miles to a dead end right before the Big Sioux River. However, Turn 1 and Turn 2 on the track run almost right next to 332nd Street, so if a race car goes off the track, it could end up on 332nd Street. This, of course, is nothing new. It's been that way for years. During one of Park Jefferson's races in May, a hobby stock car went off the track and onto the road. Then during another race 2 weeks later, a winged sprint car went off the track and onto 332nd Street, which didn't have any cars on it and is minimally used. Both races were televised, and one of the incidents went viral. The insurance company for Park Jefferson Speedway saw it and said the track needed to make sure the road was closed during races in order to remain insured. "We've gone 7 years and never had an incident with that road until then," Adamson said. "It's a very serious safety consideration. If the car flipped off and potentially killed someone, that's a big deal." Well, that's kind of an understatement, isn't it? Adamson went on to Jefferson Township in order to close the service road on race nights for about 4 to 5 hours, and it would be only next to the track. There are no entrances to fields in that area, in that stretch of the road. But the township received a couple of objections to closing the roads on those nights. So the Jefferson Township rejected Park Jefferson's request, causing the track to shut down for at least the month of June because the insurance company won't cover Park Jefferson until the situation is resolved. We're talking about 6 to 11 p.m. on Saturday nights for roughly 15 nights a year. A pretty small amount of the season will be impacted. If someone felt the need to be on that 800-foot stretch, I'm not sure why someone would need access on a Saturday night. There are no entrances to any field, no access points to roads, Adamson said. There were a couple of individuals that felt they needed access. We're working with the township. I got a document. I have to review it. We aren't even asking to use the road, just to put a road close sign on each end on race nights. Even though the first request was rejected by the township, Adamson has been working closely with the board since then to get the situation resolved. He said he understands why the decision was made and said the Jefferson Township has been wonderful to work with. They want racing at Park Jefferson. They are hamstrung because the township has certain rules and regulations to work around. I have nothing but compliments for the township, Adamson said. They are all volunteers. They are doing it to make the township of Jefferson better. They are working on the best they can and have to work through a legal process. Once we get that fixed, we should be able to race. While Park Jefferson can't hold races currently, Adamson was informed he could host tractor pulls and monster truck show. So on Saturday, July 11th, Park Jefferson Speedway will host the Monster Truck X event, the first ever monster truck event at the track since Adamson has owned it. We will see how it goes. I don't know if the names of the monster trucks, but I think it will be a very interesting show to see, Adamson said. As a kid, I went to monster truck races in South Dakota, and they really know their stuff. Gravedigger is coming, and there are going to be a lot of the name trucks on site. We are an entertainment venue, and this will entertain a lot of fans. Then Adamson is hoping to have racing again at Park Jefferson on July 18th, as long as everything gets worked out with the Jefferson Township. However, the races Adamson wants to make sure happen are on August 7th and 8th for the 7th annual J&J Fitting Iron Cup. That is our crown jewel. We have a lot of racers that come in, and we are really excited for it. Even if we can't race on July 18th or July 20th, by August 7th, I am confident we can get things fixed, Adamson said. We've raced the Iron Cup every year since it reopened, and I'm going to push for it. We have to work with Don's Pro Shop, and that's a trophy every driver wants to hold. We're going to make sure that racing happens one way or another because it's a big deal to him in the county, apparently. And our governor greenlights high school athletic events. Dateline Grimes. Iowa education officials released guidelines Thursday that will allow schools to reopen to normal activities as of July 1st without requirements that students and teachers undergo health checks, wear face coverings, or observe social distancing in schools. The plan is in line with Governor Kim Reynolds' move to allow public gatherings again after she had imposed restrictions to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Reynolds had initially ordered schools across the state to close in March and extended her action in April for the remainder of the school year. Reynolds said sporting events can proceed with social distancing, good hygiene, and sanitizing equipment. These kids need opportunities to find some normalcy in their lives, and it is a balance. We cannot shut down forever, she said. Iowa had an additional 462 positive cases on Thursday for a total of 27,000 total positive cases and more deaths, four more, bringing the state total to almost 700. Reynolds noted, however, that you still have to balance. You can kill some old people as long as the kids get to have fun. The school opening guidance was posted on the department's website on Thursday in preparation for beginning the school year, which for most schools occurs in mid to late August. It calls for staff or students who are sick to remain home, but it doesn't require temperature checks or any other health screenings before entering schools, saying it's not a CDC recommendation because one symptom is not necessarily indicative of communicable disease. Reynolds made the announcement on the same day that Principal Park in Des Moines announced a staff member had tested positive for the coronavirus, and that high school baseball games that had been scheduled for that minor league ballpark in Des Moines would be canceled. But Kim says not to worry. You are listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, June 26, 2020 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. The first is from Sioux City. Wilma L. Thompson, 77, died Thursday, June 25th. Waterbury Funeral Service of Sioux City is in charge. And from Emmitsburg, Iowa, but formerly of Sioux City, Julia F. Judy Nixon, 80, died Friday, April 3rd. Graveside services will be July 4th at 10 a.m. at St. John's Catholic Cemetery in Emmitsburg. Visitation will be July 3rd from 4 to 7 at Martin Matisse Funeral Home in Emmitsburg. From Grand Island, Nebraska, but formerly of Lexington, Nebraska, Eugene F. Blue Decker, 70, of Grand Island, formerly of Lexington, passed away Tuesday, June 23rd, at his home. A celebration of life will be 11 a.m. Saturday at Reynolds Love Funeral Home in Lexington, with Reverend Robert Kiefner officiating. The service will be streamed live on the Reynolds Love Facebook page. Graveside services with military rites will be 2 p.m. Monday in Memorial Park Cemetery in Sioux City, with the Reverend Bill Davis officiating. There will be a book signing from 9 a.m. until service time Saturday at the funeral home. Please share online condolences with the family by visiting the Reynolds Funeral Home website. Eugene was born August 31, 1949, in rural Lone Rock, Iowa, to Clinton and Stella Lucille Gordon Decker. Eugene attended schools in Algona, Iowa, and graduated high school in 1968 at Luverne, Iowa. He began work for IBP in 1968 on their construction crew in Dakota City, Nebraska. Gene enlisted in the U.S. Army Reserves in 1969 and served 7 years, earning the rank of Staff Sergeant. Gene was united in marriage to Susan Marie Gamble on September 26, 1970. The couple would have celebrated their 50-year anniversary this September. They had one son, Chris. Gene retired in April 2015 at the Lexington Tyson Beef Plant. He then worked for the city of Lexington, mowing the cemeteries. On June 1, 2017, the couple moved to Grand Island to be closer to their son, Chris, and their daughter-in-law, April. After moving to Grand Island, Gene mowed parks, and he hiked and biked the trails for 1 year. Gene enjoyed bowling, golf, and hunting trips with his son. The family enjoyed a trip to northern Canada to hunt bear and fish in 2018. Gene was a longtime fan of the Chicago Cubs. He also had the opportunity to work with his son, Chris, on his 1963 Impala. He loved spending time with his family and playing with the grandkids. Memorials are suggested to the St. Jude Children's Hospital or the Lexington Men's Bowling Association. And from Whiting, Iowa, Patrick Neal Mitchell, 66, of Whiting, passed away unexpectedly on Wednesday, June 24th, at his residence. The celebration of life service will be 10 a.m. Friday, July 3rd, at Rush Family Care Service in Ottawa. with Jeff Thielander officiating. Social distancing measures must be followed. Graveside services will be noon Friday, July 3rd in Calvary Cemetery in Sioux City, and condolences may be left on the Rush Funeral Home website. Patrick was born on November 13, 1953 in Sioux City, the son of John P. and Virginia L. Rowe Mitchell. He attended East High School in Sioux City. He went on to culinary arts school and became a chef. Patrick worked as a chef for several local restaurants. He loved his kitties, woodworking, and drinking PBR. He enjoyed all the holiday celebrations and spending time with his family. And from Sioux City, Bruce D. Garbe, G-A-R-B-E, 66, of Sioux City, passed away Monday, June 22nd at a local hospital. Memorial services will be 2 p.m. Saturday at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel, and visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service at the funeral home. Online condolences may be left on the Meyer Brothers website. Bruce was born on November 16, 1953 in Sioux City to Leonard Otto and Frances Jane Shelton Garbe. He attended Sioux City schools and graduated from East High School in 1972. On September 16, 1977, he married Patricia Jo Bonas at Redeemer Lutheran Church. Following graduation, he took carpentry courses at Western Iowa Tech Community College. He worked for Cashway Lumber and Walensky Lumber until 1989, when he started working for the Sioux City Assessor's Office as an appraiser. He retired from his position after approximately 20 years. Bruce was a member of the Tri-State Antique Tractor Association and the Woodbury County Zoning Board. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the Peer Center for Autism for Capital Campaign, and in honor of Bruce for his sweet granddaughter, Arabelle. And from Mobile, Iowa, Charlene K. Grell, 73, of Mobile, passed away Wednesday, June 17th at a Sioux City hospital. Services will be 10:30 a.m. Saturday at Immaculate Conception Church in Mobile, with Monsignor R. Mark Duchesne officiating. Burial will be in Arlington Cemetery. Visitation will be 4 to 8 p.m. today, with a scriptural prayer service at 8 p.m. at Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home in Mobile. Immaculate Conception Church will require all attendees of the funeral mass to wear a mask and follow social distancing guidelines. Charlene K. Grell was born December 4, 1946, in Danbury to Gilbert F. and Ruby Botker Yule. She was a graduate of Danbury Catholic High School and earned her RN from St. Vincent School of Nursing. Charlene was united in marriage to Arnold Butch Grell, Jr. on October 26, 1968, in January, and they had three children. Charlene worked as a nurse for more than 50 years. She was currently employed at Synergy Home Care and since 2009, and previously worked at Hospice of Siouxland for 16 years, Sunrise Manor, Crawford County Public Health, and Hartley Memorial Hospital in Battle Creek. She was a member of Immaculate Conception Church, where she served as secretary of the Ladies Guild and belonged to the Rosary Ladies. Charlene loved music and spent many hours listening to her hundreds of CDs. She also loved writing. She wrote in journals, letters, and many postcards and notes to anyone she thought needed it. She and Butch enjoyed camping. Charlene lived her life by the motto, faith, family, and friends. Her favorite saying that she repeated often was, trust in God, and live one day at a time. She was friendly and approachable to anyone and everyone. No one was a stranger, just a person she hadn't spoken to yet. But give her a couple of minutes, and that would change. And from Remsen, Iowa, Ronald J. Fiedler, 77, died Tuesday, May 12th. Memorial services are July 10th at 10:30 at the Fish Funeral Home and Monument in Remsen. St. Catherine Catholic Cemetery will be the burial site in Owens with military rites. Visitation will be July 10th from 9:30 a.m. on at the funeral home. And from Cherokee, Iowa, Lester P. Webb, 98, died Wednesday, June 24th. Services are June 29th at 11 a.m. at Boothby Funeral Home in Cherokee. Burial is in Oak Hill Cemetery. Visitation, June 28th from noon to 5 at the funeral home. And from Wayne, Nebraska, Blanche Heyman Johnson. 76, died Monday, June 22nd. The family services will be held June 30th at 1 p.m. at Maunderloh Smith Funeral Home in Pender. Burial will be in Evergreen Cemetery in Walt Hill, Nebraska, with visitation June 20th, 29th from 5 to 7, all at the funeral home. From Glen Grove, Iowa, Elaine Grapenthin, 94, died Thursday, June 25th. Graveside services will be June 30th at 10:30 a.m. at the Barnes Township Cemetery in Lynn Grove. Slifert Funeral Home of Sioux Rapids is in charge. And finally, from Kingsley, Iowa, Lois E. Hermanson, 89, died Wednesday, June 24th. Rhodey Funeral Home in Kingsley is in charge of it. More Siouxland briefs from today. The Siouxland Pride Alliance is hosting a Scooping the Loop event on Saturday. This is tomorrow. Siouxland Pride Alliance, a local LGBTQ organization, will be hosting its final Big Cruise event of the year with a Scooping the Loop ride that begins at 1 p.m. Saturday at Riverside Park, 1301 Riverside Boulevard, and will end in the Singing Hills area of Morningside. Participants are encouraged to decorate their vehicle to show support for the LGBTQ community in a way that is family-friendly and inclusive. These events are always to stay socially. These events are ways to stay socially distanced while still showing support for the LGBTQ community. Siouxland Pride Alliance will be hosting additional social distancing events throughout the summer. And here's a reminder that the Sioux City Hard Rock Hotel will be reopening for travelers seeking lodging accommodations beginning noon on July 1st. The 111 3rd Street facility, which had been closed since March due to COVID-19 concerns, is currently taking reservations. The casino at Hard Rock reopened on June 2nd following a state-imposed shutdown due to COVID-19. The Nebraska site will have a mobile COVID-19 testing site for residents and employees of Dakota County from 8 a.m. to noon today, Friday, at the Dakota City Fire Hall. It's 208 South 21st. By the time you hear this story, it'll be gone, but I hope you can get there. People must register online at testnebraska.com to be given a test. In addition, they must bring a QR code, either printed out or on a mobile device, to the site. People without access to a smartphone or email can call the Dakota County Health Department at 402-987-2164. Test Nebraska is a statewide initiative whose goal is to dramatically increase the rate of COVID-19 testing so Nebraskans can have access and help them stem the spread of COVID-19. People may enter the Dakota City Fire Department from the east side entrance. Dorothy Pico Nature Center will reopen with limited hours beginning on Tuesday, June 30th. The 4500 Sioux River Road facility has been closed since March. The Nature Center new limited hours will be 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Tuesday through Saturday, closed Sunday and Monday, but the trails and nature playscape will remain open. In addition, it'll be closed on July 3rd and 4th to observe the Independence Day holiday. Education Program Director Dawn Snyder said no more than 30 people will be allowed inside the facility at one time, and it will remain closed to rentals and group events. While there are currently no scheduled group tours or private events, in-person educational programs for small groups will resume with limitations in July. Some hands-on components have been removed or temporarily closed. The Nature Center will have additional hand sanitizer dispensers throughout the facility, and social distancing practices will be enforced. For more information, visit woodburyparks.org or call 712-258-0838. And the Evangelical Liberty U has been rattled by its own racial reckoning. Richmond, Virginia, as the nation wrestles with how to do more for racial equality, Liberty University, a school whose leadership has said it doesn't have a problem, is facing its own tough questions. Jerry Falwell, Jr., who leads the prominent Evangelical Christian University, apologized this month after posting a tweet invoking the blackface scandal that engulfed Virginia's governor last year. But Falwell's rare show of contrition, which followed a rebuke from nearly three dozen Black Liberty alumni, has left many African-American students, alumni, and staff unconvinced of his interest in helping the school live up to its promises about diversity. At least four Black Liberty staff members have resigned since Falwell's tweet. Several high-profile Black student athletes have announced transfer plans, and current and former students, as well as employees, have become more willing to openly criticize the university's approach to race and diversity. That shift comes as institutions across the country are grappling with the stain of racism, and internal documents show the university's share of on-campus Black students has fallen. Knowing what I know and seeing how the university has been run and even now continues to operate, it's clear that Jerry doesn't even begin to comprehend what it means to be fully apologetic. One resigned student staffer, former director of diversity and retention, Lee Kwan McLaurin, said. While pushing back against Falwell has simmered since 2016 when he endorsed Trump, his detractors have been an outspoken but undersized president in Lynchburg, where Liberty has a formidable economic footprint. Indeed, McLaurin and other disheartened Black alumni have limited power to force change. Falwell was endorsed after his apology by the school's Board of Trustees in a June 8 release that touted the school as the home for, quote, students and staff of all races, exclamation point, close quote. But interviews with more than a dozen current and former students and employees point to significant doubt that the school's culture is as welcoming as it claims. Kayvon Scott, who resigned as an online admissions counselor after Falwell's tweet, said that if he's serious, he needs to make a change, not just put it on social media. Falwell's May 27th tweet, aimed at Virginia Governor Ralph Northam's mask mandate, included a picture of a man bearing a mask, bearing a photograph of a person in blackface and another in a Ku Klux Klan costume. That photo appeared in Northam's medical school yearbook page and, when made public last year, sparked a furor that nearly forced him from office. Falwell initially defended the tweet as a response to Northam's proposed cuts to online tuition assistance. In a video interview about his apology, Falwell said, "When I was swinging at the governor, I inadvertently hit some people that love me, at Liberty African American community." The late evangelist and moral majority leader, the Reverend Jerry Falwell, founded Liberty in 1971 with just 154 students. Under the leadership of his namesake, who is an attorney and is not a minister, Liberty has grown into a leading evangelical university with an immaculate campus and a $1.6 billion endowment. The school, which declined to comment for this story, announced this year it had surpassed 100,000 students enrolled in its online programs. But Liberty's reckoning over race comes as its share of on-campus Black students has declined in recent years. Internal documents obtained by AAP show Black students made up 13% of Liberty's resident graduates in 2007, but just 5% last year. The 35 Black alumni who wrote to Falwell criticizing his rhetoric have sought to a meeting to discuss further changes. McLaurin proposed the selection of someone without financial or political ties to Liberty to execute a strategic plan for diversity, equity, inclusion, and access. An online fundraiser he launched to aid Liberty employees and teachers suffering from racial trauma has raised about $18,000. Mana Moana, a Liberty graduate who helped organize the alumni letter, said Falwell's initial apology gave him a little bit of hope that the school could become more welcoming, hope that has since faded. "I cannot recommend this place to anyone who is a marginalized person, period," Moara said. Moara lauded students and former staff who spoke out, which he said amounts to a big deal within the evangelical body of Christ, because Liberty's tentacles are so far-reaching. At least four student-athletes have announced plans to transfer out of Liberty since Falwell's tweet. Basketball player Asia Todd, who is Black, shared her decision in a video that identified racial insensitivities shown within the leadership and culture of the school. Football players Tavon Land and Crete Clark, who are also Black, shared their transfer plans in social media posts with a Black Lives Matter hashtag. Land was among the school's highest-rated football recruits. Another player, Waylon Cozad, announced his decision without explanation. Liberty's provost told news station WSET that the school had terminated a professor whose behavior contributed to Land and Clark's transfer decisions, claimed the provost. The athletes aren't alone among the disappointed. "It's a personal regret of mine getting my degree from here now," said Liberty senior Jania Berkeley, a leader at the school's Black Christian Student Association. "I would never want to give my money to a place that didn't support me, that felt like my life mattered." Thomas Starkina, who resigned as an associate director in the school's Office of Spiritual Development, said Liberty students and staff made good faith efforts to promote diversity, but its president's tweet was a tipping point. "Acknowledgement of Liberty's difficulties engaging on race isn't limited to staffers and alumni of color." Recent graduate Callum Best said that there is no serious conversation about it. "Many Christians are plenty happy to have hard conversations about issues they care about, like abortion, like homosexuality," said Best, who is white. "For whatever reason, racism is a thing they don't want to talk about. It's a personal heart issue to them, something to be prayed about." Kathy Yoder's column always inspires, and this one is titled, "Looking Back Teaches Plenty of Lessons." "I wish I knew then what I know now. I've heard people say that many, many times over the years. I can relate. It's not that I know so much, but I sure know a lot more than when I was younger. And if I knew back then what I know now, I'd have made different choices in my life. Of course, if I'd made different choices, I may not know what I know now. We can't live life backwards, but we can certainly learn from looking back. I'm thankful for my loving family, for the true friends I made along the way, for the lessons I've learned and also survived. Some lessons have taken me a long time to learn, some I'm still learning. I'm thankful for all the people the Lord has put into my path to encourage me. At times, others' words have seemed like a hug from God Himself. They always come just at the right moment, never too soon, never too late. I'm also thankful that the Lord has used me at times to encourage others. There's incredible joy in giving another person words of hope, especially when those words are from the Lord. Life is fleeting. May we all have the goal to live out God's love every day. I know firsthand how fleeting life on earth is. There's no time to dawdle. Tell your loved ones that you love them today, and then treat them like you really do. Be thankful that they're in your life. Realize that everyone is busy, and then make time for them before time slips away. Live your life without regrets. My greatest example of this is when my husband Dave was diagnosed with acute leukemia. I made up my mind that I would do everything I possibly could to help him. I also took my mom's advice. She said, cherish this time. I did. Strangely, as I look back on those 8 months, they are happy months. I still smile when I remember the day Dave looked at me pensively and said, you've been really great through all of this. There was just the slightest hint of surprise in his voice. We laughed, we cried, we laughed some more. We spent time with those we love, especially our son Ethan. We had great conversations, and through it all, we had hope. That's the key. We had hope in the Lord. That's what makes all the difference. One time, as the three of us stood looking out on the fourth floor hospital window, three eagles appeared out of nowhere and just stayed right there for a long time. They soared around, and they even performed some beautiful loop-de-loops. That favorite Bible verse seemed to come alive right before us. Those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. Isaiah 40:31. We were amazed and encouraged. One day early on, Dave had a revelation. All alone at night in the hospital, he became afraid. So he did the only thing he could think of. He prayed. And while he was praying, the peace that passes all understanding covered him like a blanket. I've read about that peace in the Bible, but I've never experienced it before, he said. It's amazing. And in that moment, I knew that whether God healed me on earth or healed me in heaven, I'd be all right. When Dave passed away, he was more than all right. He passed from mortal life on this earth to eternal life in heaven. He had no regrets in choosing to follow the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings. In fact, I believe that he's eternally grateful that he did. Let us hold unswervingly to the hope that we profess, for he who promised is faithful. That's from Hebrews 10:23. One of the greatest things I've learned in this life prepares me for the next. God is faithful. He's true. He's constant, and he's real. Nothing compares to him. No one can match him. No one can take him away from you or me unless we allow them to. No matter what we face in life, the Lord is with us. There's only one catch. We must ask him to be the Lord of our life. When we do, we'll regret the life we've lived without him, but he'll take that regret and turn it into a testimony. He'll use our testimony to encourage others. He'll use everything we surrender to him for good. So surrender it all. Make the choice today before today becomes yesterday and it's too late. Choose Jesus and choose life. Choose eternity in heaven. If you do, you'll have no regrets. May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. That's from Romans 15:13. Well, that concludes the reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, June 26, 2020. I've been your reader, Alan Fredrigal, and you can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Xofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once weekly or twice monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. Dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.